The bold move. You establish a precedent. In every subsequent encounter, people will be on the defensive, in terror of your next strike. Going halfway with a half a heart digs the deeper grave. If you enter an action with less than total confidence, you set up obstacles in your own path. When a problem arises, you will grow confused, seeing options where there are none, and inadvertently creating more problems still. Retreating from the hunter, the timid hare scurries more easily into his snares. Hesitation creates gaps, boldness obliterates them. When you take time to think, to hem and haw, you create a gap that allows others time to think as well. Your timidity infects people with awkward energy, elicits embarrassment. Doubt springs up on all sides. Boldness destroys such gaps. The swiftness of the move and the energy of the action leave others no space to doubt and worry. In seduction, hesitation is fatal. It makes your victim conscious of your intentions. The bold move crowns seduction with triumph. It leaves no time for reflection. Audacity separates you from the herd. Boldness gives you presence and makes you seem larger than life. The timid fade into the wallpaper. The bold draw attention, and what draws attention draws power. We cannot keep our eyes off the audacious. We cannot wait to see their next bold move. Observance of the law. In 1514, the 22-year-old Pietro Aretino was working as a lowly assistant scullion to a wealthy Roman family. He had ambitions of greatness as a writer, to inflame the world with his name, but how could a mere lackey hope to realize such dreams? That year, Pope Leo X received from the King of Portugal an embassy that included many gifts, most prominent among them a great elephant, the first in Rome since imperial times. The pontiff adored this elephant and showered it with attention and gifts. But despite his love and care, the elephant, which was called Anno, became deathly ill. The Pope summoned doctors who administered a 500-pound purgative to the elephant, but all to no avail. The animal died, and the Pope went into mourning. To console himself, he summoned the great painter Raphael and ordered him to create a life-sized painting of Anno above the animal's tomb, bearing the inscription, "What nature took away, Raphael has with his art restored." Over the next few days, a pamphlet circulated throughout Rome that caused great merriment and laughter. Entitled, "The Last Will and Testament of the Elephant Anno," it read in part, "To my heir, the Cardinal Santa Croce, I give my knees so that he can imitate my genuflections. To my heir, Cardinal Santi Quattro, I give my jaws so that he can more readily devour all of Christ's revenues. To my heir, Cardinal Medici, I give my ears so that he can hear everyone's doings. To Cardinal Grassi, who had a reputation for lechery, the elephant bequeathed the appropriate oversized part of his own anatomy." On and on the anonymous pamphlet went, sparing none of the great in Rome, not even the Pope. With each one, it took aim at their best-known weakness. The pamphlet ended with verse, "See to it that Aretino is your friend, for he is a bad enemy to have. His words alone could ruin the High Pope. So God guard everyone from his tongue." Interpretation. With one short pamphlet, Aretino, son of a poor shoemaker and a servant himself, hurled himself to fame. Everyone in Rome rushed to find out who this daring young man was. Even the Pope, amused by his audacity, sought him out and ended up giving him a job in the papal service. Over the years, he came to be known as the Scourge of Princes and his biting tongue earned him the respect and fear of the great, from the King of France to the Habsburg Emperor. The Aretino strategy is simple. When you are as small and obscure as David was, you must find a Goliath to attack. The larger the target, the more attention you gain. The bolder the attack, the more you stand out from the crowd and the more admiration you earn. Society is full of those who think daring thoughts, but lack the guts to print and publicize them. Voice what the public feels. The expression of shared feelings is always powerful. Search out the most prominent target possible and sling your boldest shot. The world will enjoy the spectacle and will honor the underdog. You, that is, with glory and power. Keys to power. Most of us are timid. We want to avoid tension and conflict, and we want to be liked by all. We may contemplate a bold action, but we rarely bring it to life. We are terrified of the consequences, of what others might think of us, of the hostility we will stir up if we dare go beyond our usual place. Although we may disguise our timidity as a concern for others, a desire not to hurt or offend them, in fact, it is the opposite. We are really self-absorbed, worried about ourselves and how others perceive us. Boldness, on the other hand, is outer-directed and often makes people feel more at ease since it is less self-conscious and less repressed. Few are born bold. Even Napoleon had to cultivate the habit on the battlefield, where he knew it was a matter of life and death. In social settings, he was awkward and timid, but he overcame this and practiced boldness in every part of his life because he saw its tremendous power, how it could literally enlarge a man, even one who, like Napoleon, was in fact conspicuously small. You must practice and develop your boldness. You will often find uses for it. The best place to begin is often the delicate world of negotiation, particularly those discussions in which you are asked to set your own price. How often we put ourselves down by asking for too little. When Christopher Columbus proposed that the Spanish court finance his voyage to the Americas, he also made the insanely bold demand that he be called Grand Admiral of the Ocean. The court agreed. The price he set was the price he received. He demanded to be treated with respect, and so he was. Understand, if boldness is not natural, neither is timidity. It is an acquired habit, picked up out of a desire to avoid conflict. If timidity has taken hold of you, then root it out. Your fears of the consequences of a bold action are way out of proportion to reality. And in fact, the consequences of timidity are worse. Your value is lowered and you create a self-fulfilling cycle of doubt and disaster. Remember, the problems created by an audacious move can be disguised, even remedied, by more and greater audacity. Law 29. Plan all the way to the end. Judgment. The ending is everything. Plan all the way to it, taking into account all the possible consequences, obstacles, and twists of fortune that might reverse your hard work and give the glory to others. By planning to the end, you will not be overwhelmed by circumstances, and you will know when to stop. Gently guide fortune and help determine the future by thinking far ahead. Transgression of the law. You see the ending and you tolerate no deviation. Law 30. Make your accomplishments seem effortless. Judgment. Your actions must seem natural and executed with ease. All the toil and practice that go into them, and also all the clever tricks, must be concealed. When you act, act effortlessly, as if you could do much more. Avoid the temptation of revealing how hard you work. It only raises questions. Teach no one your tricks, or they will be used against you. Observance of the law. The great escape artist Harry Houdini once advertised his act as the impossible possible. And indeed, those who witnessed his dramatic escapes felt that what he did on stage contradicted common sense ideas of human capacity. Over the years, Houdini escaped from the chained carcass of an embalmed sea monster, a half-octopus, half-whale-like beast that had beached near Boston. He had himself sealed inside an enormous envelope from which he emerged without breaking the paper. He passed through brick walls. He wriggled free from straitjackets while dangling high in the air. He leaped from bridges into icy waters, his hands manacled and his legs in chains. He had himself submerged in glass cases full of water, hands padlocked, while the audience watched in amazement as he worked himself free, struggling for close to an hour, apparently without breathing. Each time, he seemed to court certain death, yet survived with superhuman aplomb. Meanwhile, he said nothing about his methods, gave no clues as to how he accomplished any of his tricks. He left his audiences and critics speculating, his power and reputation enhanced by their struggles with the inexplicable. Perhaps the most baffling trick of all was making a 10,000-pound elephant disappear before an audience's eyes, a feat he repeated on stage for over 19 weeks. No one has ever really explained how he did this, for in the auditorium where he performed the trick, there was simply nowhere for an elephant to hide. The effortlessness of Houdini's escapes led some to think he used occult forces, his superior psychic abilities giving him special control over his body. But a German escape artist named Klapini claimed to know Houdini's secret. He simply used elaborate gadgets. Klapini also claimed to have defeated Houdini in a handcuff challenge in Holland. Houdini did not mind all kinds of speculation floating around about his methods, but he would not tolerate an outright lie. And in 1902, he challenged Klapini to a handcuff duel. Klapini accepted. Interpretation. Although we do not know for certain how Houdini accomplished many of his most ingenious escapes, one thing is clear. It was not the occult, or any kind of magic, that gave him his powers, but hard work and endless practice, all of which he carefully concealed from the world. Houdini never left anything to chance. Day and night, he studied the workings of locks, researched centuries-old sleight-of-hand tricks, pored over books on mechanics, whatever he could use. Every moment not spent researching, he spent working his body, keeping himself exceptionally limber, and learning how to control his muscles and his breathing. Early on in Houdini's career, an old Japanese performer whom he toured with taught him an ancient trick, how to swallow an ivory ball, then bring it back up. He practiced this endlessly with a small peeled potato tied to a string. Up and down, he would manipulate the potato with his throat muscles until they were strong enough to move it without the string. No one could check the inside of his throat, where he could conceal small tools to help him escape. Even so, Klapini was fundamentally wrong. It was not Houdini's tools, but his practice, work, and research that made his escapes possible. Klapini, in fact, was completely outwitted by Houdini, who set the whole thing up. He let his opponent learn the code to the French cuffs, then baited him into choosing those cuffs on stage. Then, during the two men's tussle, the dexterous Houdini was able to change the code to FRAUD. He had spent weeks practicing this trick, but the audience saw none of the sweat and toil behind the scenes. Nor was Houdini ever nervous. He induced nervousness in others. He deliberately dragged out the time it would take to escape as a way of heightening the drama, and making the audience squirm. His escapes from death, always graceful and easy, made him look like a Superman. As a person of power, you must research and practice endlessly before appearing in public, on stage, or anywhere else. Never expose the sweat and labor behind your poise. Some think such exposure will demonstrate their diligence and honesty, but it actually just makes them look weaker, as if anyone who practiced and worked at it could do what they had done, or as if they weren't really up to the job. Keep your effort and your tricks to yourself, and you seem to have the grace and ease of a god. One never sees the source of a god's power revealed. One only sees its effects. Keys to Power. In the Book of the Courtier, published in 1528, Baldassare Castiglione describes the highly elaborate and codified manners of the perfect court citizen. And yet, Castiglione explains the courtier must execute these gestures with what he calls sprezzatura, the capacity to make the difficult seem easy. He urges the courtier to practice in all things a certain nonchalance which conceals all artistry and makes whatever one says or does seem uncontrived and effortless. We all admire the achievement of some unusual feat, but if it is accomplished naturally and gracefully, our admiration increases tenfold. Whereas, to labor at what one is doing and to make bones over it shows an extreme lack of grace and causes everything, whatever it's worth, to be discounted. The idea of sprezzatura is relevant to all forms of power, for power depends vitally on appearances and the illusions you create. Your public actions are like artworks. They must have visual appeal, must create anticipation, even entertain. When you reveal the inner workings of your creation, you become just one more mortal among others. What is understandable is not awe-inspiring. We tell ourselves we could do as well if we had the money and time. Avoid the temptation of showing how clever you are. It is far more clever to conceal the mechanisms of your cleverness. There is another reason for concealing your shortcuts and tricks. When you let this information out, you give people ideas they can use against you. You lose the advantages of keeping silent. We tend to want the world to know what we have done. We want our vanity gratified by having our hard work and cleverness applauded. And we may even want sympathy for the hours it has taken to reach our point of artistry. Learn to control this propensity to blab, for its effect is often the opposite of what you expected. Remember, the more mystery surrounds your actions, the more awesome your power seems. You appear to be the only one who can do what you do, and the appearance of having an exclusive gift is immensely powerful. Finally, because you achieve your accomplishments with grace and ease, people believe that you could always do more if you tried harder. This elicits not only admiration, but a touch of fear. Your powers are untapped. No one can fathom their limits. Law 31. Control the options. Judgment. Everyone understands the need for change in the abstract, but on the day-to-day level, people are creatures of habit. Too much innovation is traumatic and will lead to revolt. If you are new to a position of power or an outsider trying to build a power base, make a show of respecting the old ways of doing things. If change is necessary, make it feel like a gentle improvement on the past. Transgression of the law. A terror fell on the country. Some people had suffered under the Catholic Church, which, before the reforms, had been immensely powerful, but most Britons had strong ties to Catholicism and to its comforting rituals. They watched in horror as churches were demolished, images of the Madonna and saints were broken in pieces, stained glass windows were smashed, and the church's treasures were confiscated. With monasteries that had succored the poor suddenly gone, the poor now flooded the streets. The growing ranks of the beggar class were further swelled by former monks. On top of all this, Cromwell levied high taxes to pay for his ecclesiastical reforms. In 1535, powerful revolts in the north of England threatened to topple Henry from his throne. By the following year, he had suppressed the rebellions, but he had also begun to see the costs of Cromwell's reforms. The king himself had never wanted to go this far. He had only wanted a divorce. It was now Cromwell's turn to watch uneasily as the king began slowly to undo his reforms, reinstating Catholic sacraments and other rituals that Cromwell had outlawed. Cromwell was arrested, charged as a Protestant extremist and a heretic, and sent to the Tower. 6 weeks later, before a large and enthusiastic crowd, the public executioner cut off his head. Interpretation. Thomas Cromwell had a simple idea. He would break up the power and wealth of the church and lay the foundation for Protestantism in England. And he would do this in a mercilessly short time. He knew his speedy reforms would cause pain and resentment, but he thought these feelings would fade in a few years. More important, by identifying himself with change, he would become the leader of the new order, making the king dependent on him. But there was a problem in this strategy. Like a billiard ball hit too hard against the cushion, his reforms had reactions and caroms he did not envision and could not control. The man who initiates strong reforms often becomes the scapegoat for any kind of dissatisfaction. And eventually the reaction to his reforms may consume him, for change is upsetting to the human animal, even when it is for the good. Because the world is, and always has been, full of insecurity and threat, we latch on to familiar faces and create habits and rituals to make the world more comfortable. Change can be pleasant and even sometimes desirable in the abstract, but too much of it creates an anxiety that will stir and boil beneath the surface and then eventually erupt. Never underestimate the hidden conservatism of those around you. It is powerful and entrenched. Never let the seductive charm of an idea cloud your reason. Just as you cannot make people see the world your way, you cannot wrench them into the future with painful changes. They will rebel. If reform is necessary, anticipate the reaction against it and find ways to disguise the change and sweeten the poison. And the need for change, knowing how important it is for institutions and individuals to be occasionally renewed. They are also irritated and upset by changes that affect them personally. They know the change is necessary and that novelty provides relief from boredom, but deep inside, they cling to the past. Change in the abstract or superficial change they desire, but a change that upsets core habits and routines is deeply disturbing to them. No revolution is done without a powerful later reaction against it, for in the long run, the void it creates proves too unsettling to the human animal, who unconsciously associates such voids with death and chaos. The opportunity for change and renewal seduces people to the side of the revolution, but once their enthusiasm fades, which it will, they are left with a certain emptiness. Yearning for the past, they create an opening for it to creep back in. For Machiavelli, the prophet who preaches and brings change can only survive by taking up arms. When the masses inevitably yearn for the past, he must be ready to use force. But the armed prophet cannot last long unless he quickly creates a new set of values and rituals to replace the old ones and to soothe the anxieties of those who dread change. It is far easier and less bloody to play a kind of con game. Preach change as much as you like, and even enact your reforms, but give them the comforting appearance of older events and traditions. A simple gesture like using an old title or keeping the same number for a group will tie you to the past and support you with the authority of history. As Machiavelli himself observed, the Romans used this device when they transformed their monarchy into a republic. They may have installed two consuls in place of the king, but since the king had been served by 12 lictors, they retained the same number to serve under the consuls. The king had personally performed an annual sacrifice in a great spectacle that stirred the public. The Republic retained this practice, only transferring it to a special chief of the ceremony, whom they called the King of the Sacrifice. These and similar gestures satisfied the people and kept them from clamoring for the monarchy's return. Another strategy to disguise change is to make a loud and public display of support for the values of the past. Seem to be a zealot for tradition, and few will notice how unconventional you really are. The answer to innate conservatism is to play the courtier's game. Galileo did this at the beginning of his scientific career. He later became more confrontational and paid for it. So pay lip service to tradition. Identify the elements in your revolution that can be made to seem to build on the past. Say the right things. Make a show of conformity, and meanwhile, let your theories do their radical work. Play with appearances and respect past protocol. Finally, powerful people pay attention to the zeitgeist. If their reform is too far ahead of its time, few will understand it, and it will stir up anxiety and be hopelessly misinterpreted. The changes you make must seem less innovative than they are. England did eventually become a Protestant nation, as Cromwell wished, but it took over a century of gradual evolution. Watch the zeitgeist. If you work in a tumultuous time, there is power to be gained by preaching a return to the past, to comfort, tradition, and ritual. During a period of stagnation, on the other hand, play the card of reform and revolution, but beware of what you stir up. Those who finish a revolution are rarely those who start it. You will not succeed at this dangerous game unless you are willing to forestall the inevitable reaction against it by playing with appearances and building on the past. Law 46. Never appear too perfect. Judgment. Appearing better than others is always dangerous, but most dangerous of all is to appear to have no faults or weaknesses. Envy creates silent enemies. It is smart to occasionally display defects and admit to harmless vices in order to deflect envy and appear more human and approachable. Only gods and the dead can seem perfect with impunity. Transgression of the law. Keys to power. Power has its own rhythms and patterns. Those who succeed at the game are the ones who control the patterns and vary them at will, keeping people off balance while they set the tempo. The essence of strategy is controlling what comes next, and the elation of victory can upset your ability to control what comes next in two ways. First, you owe your success to a pattern that you are apt to try to repeat. You will try to keep moving in the same direction without stopping to see whether this is still the direction that is best for you. Second, success tends to go to your head and make you emotional. Feeling invulnerable, you make aggressive moves that ultimately undo the victory you have gained. The lesson is simple. The powerful vary their rhythms and patterns, change course, adapt to circumstance, and learn to improvise. Rather than letting their dancing feet impel them forward, they step back and look where they are going. It is as if their bloodstream bore a kind of antidote to the intoxication of victory, letting them control their emotions and come to a kind of mental halt when they have attained success. They steady themselves, give themselves the space to reflect on what has happened, examine the role of circumstance and luck in their success. As they say in riding school, you have to be able to control yourself before you can control the horse. Law 48. Assume formlessness. Judgment. By taking a shape, by having a visible plan, you open yourself to attack. Instead of taking